Casting a preparatory glance at the bottom of this article, as the wary connoisseur in prints, with cursory eye, which, while it reads, seems as though it read not, never fails to consult the quis sculpsit in the corner, before he pronounces some rare piece to be a vivar, or a woollet. Methinks I hear you exclaim, reader, who is Elijah? Because in my last I tried to divert thee with some half-forgotten humours of some old clerks defunct, in an old house of business, long since gone to decay, doubtless you have already set me down in your mind as one of the self-same college, a votary of the desk, a notched and cropped scrivener, one that sucks his sustenance, as certain sick people are said to do, through a quill. Well, I do acknowledge something of the sort. I confess that it is my humour, my fancy, in the forepart of the day, when the mind of your man of letters requires some relaxation, and none better than such as at first sight seems most abhorrent from his beloved studies, to while away some good hours of my time in the contemplation of indigos, cottons, raw silks, piece goods, flowered or otherwise. In the first place, and then it sends you home with such increased appetite to your books, not to say that your outside sheets and waist wrappers of foolscap do receive into them, most kindly and naturally, the impression of sonnets, epigrams, essays, so that the very pairings of a counting-house are, in some sort, the settings-up of an author. The enfranchised quill that has plodded all the morning among the cart-rucks of figures and ciphers, frisks and curvets so at its ease over the flowery carpet-ground of a midnight dissertation. It feels its promotion. So that you see, upon the whole, the literary dignity of Elijah is very little, if at all, compromised in the condescension. Not that, in my anxious detail of the many commodities incidental to the life of a public office, I would be thought blind to certain flaws which a cunning carper might be able to pick in this Joseph's vest. And here I must have leave, in the fullness of my soul, to regret the abolition and doing away with altogether of those consolatory interstices and sprinklings of freedom through the four seasons, the red-letter days, now become to all intents and purposes dead-letter days. There was Paul and Stephen and Barnabas, Andrew and John, men famous in old times. We were used to keep all their days holy, as long back as I was at school at Christ's. I remember their effigies, by the same token, in the old basket prayer book. There hung Peter, in his uneasy posture, holy Bartlemy in the troublesome act of flaying after the famous Marcius by Spagnoletti. I honoured them all, and could almost have wept the defalcation of Iscariot. So much did we love to keep holy memories sacred. Only methought, I a little grudged at the coalition of the better Jude with Simon, clubbing, as it were, their sanctities together, to make up one poor gaudy day between them, as an economy unworthy of the dispensation. These were bright visitations in a scholar's and a clerk's life. Far off their coming shone. I was as good as an almanac in those days. I could have told you such a saint's day falls out next week, or the week after. Peradventure the Epiphany, by some periodical infelicity, would, once in 6 years, merge in a Sabbath. Now am I little better than one of the profane. Let me not be thought to arraign the wisdom of my civil superiors, who have judged the further observation of these holy tides to be papistical, superstitious. Only, in a custom of such long standing, methinks, if their holinesses the bishops had, in decency, been first sounded. But I am wading out of my depths. I am not the man to decide the limits of civil and ecclesiastical authority. I am plain Elijah, no Selden, nor Archbishop Usher, though at present in the thick of their books, here in the heart of learning, under the shadow of the mighty Bodley. I can here play the gentleman, enact the student. To such a one as myself, who has been defrauded in his young years of the sweet food of academic institution, nowhere is so pleasant, to while away a few idle weeks at, as one or other of the universities. Their vacation, too, at this time of year, falls in so pat with ours. Here I can take my walks unmolested, and fancy myself of what degree or standing I please. I seem admitted ad eundem. I fetch up past opportunities. I can rise at the chapel bell and dream that it rings for me. In moods of humility, I can be a sizer or a servitor. When the peacock vein rises, I strut a gentleman commoner. In graver moments, I proceed master of arts. Indeed, I do not think I am much unlike that respectable character. I have seen your dim-eyed vergers and bedmakers in spectacles drop a bow or curtsy as I pass, wisely mistaking me for something of the sort. I go about in black, which favours the notion. Only, in Christchurch reverent quadrangle, I can be content to pass for nothing short of a seraphic doctor. The walks at these times are so much one's own, the tall trees of Christ's, the groves of Magdalen. The halls deserted, and with open doors, inviting one to slip in unperceived, and pay a devoir to some founder, or noble or royal benefactress that should have been ours, whose portrait seems to smile upon their overlooked beadsmen, and to adopt me for their own. Then, to take a peep in by the way at the butteries and sculleries, redolent of antique hospitality. The immense caves of kitchens, kitchen fireplaces, cordial recesses. Ovens whose first pies were baked 4 centuries ago, and spits which have cooked for Chaucer. Not the meanest minister among the dishes, but is hallowed to me through his imagination, and the cook goes forth emancipable. Antiquity, thou wondrous charm, what art thou? That being nothing art everything. When thou wert not antiquity, then thou wert nothing, but hadst a remoter antiquity, as thou call'st it, to look back to with blind veneration. Thou thyself being to thyself flat, jejune, modern. What mystery lurks in this retroversion? Or what half Januses are we, that cannot look forward with the same idolatry with which we for ever revert? The mighty future is as nothing, being everything. The past is everything, being nothing. What were thy dark ages? Surely the sun rose as brightly then as now, and man got him to his work in the morning. Why is it that we can never hear mention of them without an accompanying feeling, as though a palpable obscure had dimmed the face of things, and that our ancestors wandered to and fro groping? Above all thy rarities, old Oxenford, what do most aride and solace me? are thy repositories of mouldering learning, thy shelves. What a place to be in is an old library. It seems as though all the souls of all the writers that have bequeathed their labours to these Bodleians were reposing here, as in some dormitory or middle state. I do not want to handle, to profane the leaves, their winding sheets. I could as soon dislodge a shade. I seem to inhale learning, walking amid their foliage, and the odour of their old moth-scented coverings is fragrant as the first bloom of those cyantial apples which grew amid the happy orchard. Still less have I curiosity to disturb the elder repose of manuscripts. Those variae lectiones, so tempting to the more erudite palates, do but disturb and unsettle my faith. There is something to me repugnant at any time in written hand. The text never seems determinate. Print settles it. I had thought of the Lycidas as of a full-grown beauty, as springing up with all its parts absolute, till, in evil hour, I was shown the original written copy of it, together with the other minor poems of its author, in the Library of Trinity, kept like some treasure to be proud of. I wish they had thrown them in the cam, or sent them, after the latter cantos of Spenser, into the Irish Channel. How it staggered me to see the fine things in their ore, interlined, corrected, as if their words were mortal, alterable, displaceable at pleasure, as if they might have been otherwise, and just as good. As if inspirations were made up of parts, and those fluctuating, successive, indifferent. I will never go into the workshop of any great artist again, nor desire a sight of his picture till it is fairly off the easel. No, not if Raphael were to be alive again and painting another Galatea. I am no Herculanean raker. The credit of the three witnesses might have slept unimpeached for me. I leave these curiosities to Porson and to George Dyer, whom, by the way, I found busy as a moth over some rotten archive rummaged out of some seldom-explored press in a nook at Oriel. With long poring, he has grown almost into a book. He stood as passive as one by the side of the old shelves. I long to new-coat him in Russia and assign him his place. He might have mustered for a tall scapula. Dyer is assiduous in his visits to these seats of learning. No inconsiderable portion of his moderate fortune, I apprehend, is consumed in journeys between them and Clifford's Inn, where, like a dove on the asp's nest, he has long taken up his unconscious abode. Amid an incongruous assembly of attorneys, attorneys' clerks, apparitors, promoters, vermin of the law, among whom he sits in calm and sinless peace. The fangs of the law pierce him not. The winds of litigation blow over his humble chambers. The hard sheriff's officer moves his hat as he passes. Legal nor illegal discourtesy touches him. None thinks of offering violence or injustice to him. You would as soon strike an abstract idea. D has been engaged, he tells me, through a course of laborious years, in an investigation into all curious matter connected with the two universities, and has lately lit upon a manuscript collection of charters relative to C, by which he hopes to settle some disputed points, particularly that long controversy between them as to priority of foundation. The ardour with which he engages in these liberal pursuits, I am afraid, has not met with all the encouragement it deserved, either here or at Cambridge. Your caputs and heads of colleges care less than anybody else about these questions, contented to suck the milky fountains of their alma maters, without inquiring into the venerable gentlewoman's years. They rather hold such curiosities to be impertinent, unreverent. They have their good glebe lands in Manu, and care not much to rake into the titled deeds. I gather at least so much from other sources, for D is not a man to complain. D started like an unbroke heifer when I interrupted him. A priori, it was not very probable that we should have met in Oriel. But D would have done the same had I accosted him on the sudden, in his own walks in Clifford's Inn or in the Temple. In addition to a provoking short-sightedness, the effect of late studies and watchings at the midnight oil, D is the most absent of men. He made a call the other morning at our friend Montague's in Bedford Square, and finding nobody at home, was ushered into the hall, where, asking for pen and ink, with great exactitude of purpose, he enters me his name in the book, which ordinarily lies about in such places, to record the failures of the untimely or unfortunate visitor, and takes his leave with many ceremonies and professions of regret. Some 2 or 3 hours after, his walking destinies returned him into the same neighbourhood again, and again the quiet image of the fireside circle at Montague's, Mrs. Montague presiding at it like a Queen Lar, with pretty Anne Skepper at her side. Striking irresistibly on his fancy, he makes another call, forgetting that they were certainly not to return from the country before that day week. And disappointed a second time, inquires for pen and paper as before. Again the book is brought, and in the line just above that in which he is about to print his second name, his rescript, his first name, scarce dry, looks out upon him like another saucier, or as if a man should suddenly encounter his own duplicate. The effect may be conceived. D made many a good resolution against any such lapses in future. I hope he will not keep them too rigorously. For with G.D., to be absent from the body is sometimes, not to speak it profanely, to be present with the Lord. At the very time when, personally encountering thee, he passes on with no recognition, or, being stopped, starts like a thing surprised. At that moment, reader, he is on Mount Tabor, or Parnassus, or co-sphered with Plato, or with Harrington framing immortal commonwealths, devising some plan of amelioration to thy country or thy species. Peradventure, meditating some individual kindness or courtesy to be done to thee thyself, the returning consciousness of which made him start so guiltily at thy obtruded personal presence. D commenced life, after a course of hard study, in the house of Pure Emmanuel, as usher to a knavish fanatic schoolmaster, at a salary of £8 per annum, with board and lodging. Of this poor stipend he never received above half, in all the laborious years he served this man. He tells a pleasant anecdote that when poverty, staring out at his ragged knees, has sometimes compelled him, against the modesty of his nature, to hint at arrears, Dr. So-and-so would take no immediate notice, but after supper, when the school was called together to evensong, he would never fail to introduce some instructive homily against riches and the corruption of the heart occasioned through the desire of them, ending with, Lord, keep thy servants above all things from the heinous sin of avarice, Having food and raiment, let us therewithal be content. Give me Aegir's wish, and the like, which to the little auditory sounded like a doctrine full of Christian prudence and simplicity, but to poor Dee was a receipt in full for that quarter's demands at least. And Dee has been underworking for himself ever since, drudging at low rates for unappreciating booksellers, wasting his fine erudition in silent corrections of the classics, and in those unostentatious but solid services to learning which commonly fall to the lot of laborious scholars who have not the art to sell themselves to the best advantage. He has published poems which do not sell because their character is unobtrusive like his own, and because he has been too much absorbed in ancient literature to know what the popular mark in poetry is, even if he could have hit it. And therefore, his verses are properly, what he terms them, crotchets, voluntaries, odes to liberty and spring, effusions, little tributes, and offerings left behind him upon tables and window seats, at parting from friends' houses, and from all the inns of hospitality, where he has been courteously, or but tolerably, received in his pilgrimage. If his muse of kindness halt a little behind the strong lines in fashion in this excitement-craving age, his prose is the best of the sort in the world, and exhibits a faithful transcript of his own healthy natural mind and cheerful innocent tone of conversation. Dee is delightful anywhere, but he is at his best in such places as these. He cares not much for Bath. He is out of his element at Buxton, at Scarborough, or Harrogate. The Cam and the Isis are to him better than all the waters of Damascus. On the Muses' Hill he is happy and good, as one of the shepherds on the Delectable Mountains. And when he goes about with you to show you the halls and colleges, you think you have with you the interpreter at the House Beautiful.